This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Dr. Andrew DeRoche, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, thanks. It's a snowy day here in Edmonton, but it's good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's same here. It's snowy and windy, and man, it's like it's 5 years, I think, this coming summer when we came up to your office in Edmonton and recorded the episode with you on polar bear conservation and the work that you have been doing for years and years. That was a really fun trip for Curtis and I, because we met you and did the podcast with you on polar bears. We met with Matt Besko. At that time, he was director of wildlife and licensing for the province of Alberta. And we also met a archaeologist in Edmonton, Jack Brink. And he was the archaeologist that did the founding work and was the person that moved Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump to be declared a World Heritage Site by UNESCO. And I'd read his book and we met him. So it was like 3 days and three amazing podcasts way back around episode 9, 10, and 11 or something like that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm teaching at the university again right now. And yesterday I was just sort of going through, I teach a course, Biology of Mammals, to fourth year students. And one of the slides I put in, why are mammals so important from a human perspective? And one of the slides I put in is about Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump, just saying, you know, it's just down the road from us. If you've never been there in Alberta, you should go take a look at that, because the history and the perspectives you get about First Nations people living on the land and the importance of buffalo is pretty interesting. And it's a very different perspective on, you know, what was here before, you know, European settlers and others moved here.
Absolutely. And the Jack's book is really good too. It's called Head Smashed In. And some of the stuff that I found in his book, like archaeology fascinates me, but what I found was really cool were some of the things that he talked about, which is actually kind of a little bit, you know, it goes against some of the prevailing narratives about hunting and about Indigenous hunters. And I remember, you know, we were just before the episode, we were talking about baiting, hunting and baiting. Well, like they were doing all types of like trickery and foolery and stuff with the bison herds. They were dressing up in the, you know, as a coyote or a baby calf or a pronghorn, and they would use buffalo chips and lay them in the snow, guiding the buffalo would think that it's a safe route to be running and things like that. They didn't always use all parts of the animals. In the fall, they harvested for meat, and in the springtime, they harvested for hides, because they couldn't use the hides in the fall because they were too thick. So they waited till they were gaunt in the springtime, harvested them just for their hides when the meat had no fat in it. So stuff like that, I find fascinating.
Well, you can imagine it was an issue of abundance. I mean, there was no shortage of bison. So you would take what you needed whenever you wanted it. And it makes perfect sense when you think about it that way. Yeah, you'd optimize what you want when you want it. And why would you make do with the second best when you can have the best?
Yeah. Just took some seasonal planning, kind of like what we do with our lives. How long have you been researching polar bears in Canada's Arctic region?
So I started 40 years ago. Oh, 1984 goodness. Was the first year that I was up in the Arctic studying polar bears. So I've been doing it for a long time. I was in the Canadian Arctic for most of my career, but I also worked in the European Arctic based out of Norway for 7 years. So I lived north of the Arctic Circle, worked for the Norwegian government there as a polar bear scientist for 7 years. So it's kept me busy. It's kept me out of trouble. I sometimes wonder how I've stayed out of trouble all those years, but guns, drugs, helicopters, it can be a little bit hairy at times.
No, I bet. Now, in that whole time span, have you had the opportunity to like work on some other wildlife species, like assisting colleagues or something like for a bit of diversity?
Yeah, actually quite a number of species. So while polar bears are sort of my core research animal, because I'm at the university, I work on a lot of different species. So we're just publishing some work on cougars in Alberta. We worked with the provincial carnivore biologist, Paul Frame, and we worked on a study with them, and they were collecting a lot of data. And of course, typical of a lot of government biologists, they don't have all the time to sit there and work through the various pieces of the information that they're collecting. So we did some work on looking at the genetic structure of cougars that have been either hunted in Alberta or that we caught during this program. And so we've got a study just coming out on that. We looked at their movement patterns. We also looked at the predator-prey relationships of what are the cougars eating. And I mean, there's some concerns in these areas about what they're eating. And, you know, there are a lot of conflicts with humans, but basically everywhere we went, what they're killing, they just kill white-tailed deer. Mm-hmm. These cougars are specialists on whitetails. We never found a moose, never found anything but that. So I've worked on cougars. I've done a fair bit of work on wolves over the years. Some work on caribou in the north, thin horn sheep, so doll sheep and stone sheep as well. I actually got involved in some peregrine falcon work, again, based out of Nunavut a number of years back. So polar bears are kind of what I do, but I've got eclectic interests. I know, I mean, looking back on time, you know, I don't think it would have mattered. I mean, I grew up in Vancouver. I was certain I was going to be a salmon biologist for a while because I just love salmon fishing so much, but that didn't work out that way. And so I've got broad interests when it comes to wildlife.
No, that's awesome. I'm the same way too. I just like squirrel, you know, just everything out there interests me. And that's why this podcast has been so fun, because it's like, you know, yourself on polar bears and then somebody on snowshoe hares or red squirrels. And like, it's just all so fascinating. Have you been a hunter your whole life? Like, did you grow up in a hunting family as a kid and hunted with your family?
No, it's interesting. I didn't. And that's kind of one of those things. Like when I was a kid, like I would just devour books on wildlife, like anything like bird books. I would sit there for hours. You know, just I probably learned more to ID birds and mammals when I was, you know, preteen years than I did afterwards. But my grandfather on my mom's side hunted, but he was from Quebec. And so I've still got his old rifles and things, old Winchester, you know, things like that. But he never really talked much about it. I was interested in it. I always wanted to hunt, but my father didn't hunt, and neither did any of my other family out in Vancouver. So basically, there were a couple of events I can think that were pretty formative when I was younger. One of them was I lived in right in the heart of Vancouver at the time when I was a kid. And our neighbors in Vancouver, they hunted. And they took me out after ducks, basically out into the Delta, Fraser Delta area, and then actually went pheasant hunting with them out in a couple of corn sites out probably farther towards Chilliwack way. And so that probably got me interested. But it wasn't until I moved to Alberta to do graduate work at the University of Alberta that I hooked up with some people that were hunters, and they sort of, you know, mentored me into how to hunt. And, you know, you sort of think, oh, how do you mentor somebody in hunting? And basically, it's just like, well, you get yourself a rifle and you come with us and you go over there. And that was kind of it. But, you know, you sit around the camp for enough weeks and you sort of walk around enough and you sort of figure it out and you get some pointers and tips about where you should go, what you shouldn't be doing. And yeah. And then that was 40 years. So I've been hunting 40 years now. Even when we lived overseas, it's harder to hunt big game overseas. But I spent a lot of time in the mountains in northern Norway hunting, capercaillie and black grouse and ptarmigan over there.
Wow. Those capercaillie are so cool.
I shot at a couple and we put them up and, but it was like, but I mean, you know what it's like? Half of it's just the joy of being in those places.
Unreal.
And
I'd be just, you know, if I saw one of those things lift off in front of me, I'd probably be like awestruck before you'd shoulder your shotgun.
They're pretty impressive. And they're canny birds too. They haven't figured out how not to get shot. So they do a lot of things. You do a lot of running in that hunting. At least I was doing it with my dog. Because they're so big, if they're not in trees, they really do need some sort of place to take off from, it seems. And they run to cliffs. So, you know, you got to be a little bit careful up in the mountains that you don't go running after them and follow them off a cliff.
Oh, geez. So your hunting experiences and interests, are they as diverse as your general wildlife interests as well? Like, are you upland, waterfowl, big game, or did that change over your lifetime? Or
it's, you know, I hunt both upland, waterfowl, not so much waterfowl. I've got a golden retriever and I just, you know, I bring him home after a day on the marsh and it's just so much work to get him cleaned up. And my wife won't let him in the house when he stinks. And you know, it's prairie marshlands. They stink after a day on a small, you know, prairie pothole thing. So I'm more upland now and big game. And for me, big game is, this year I was hunting whitetail, and a little bit of cow elk. I had a cow elk tag. I mean, it was such a weird year for us this past fall. It was so warm. It really was just awful hunting conditions. We had no snow on the ground. And in reality, this year, I didn't really need the meat that much, so I wasn't that pressured. And I did a lot of pheasant hunting. We got lots of good pheasant release areas just to the southeast of us here. And so I take the dog out. I mean, I love hunting upland. I was out just last Friday because the upland season here is open quite late into mid-January. And I was out. It was the last of our nice warm days, I think, for this winter. And just took the day and just went for a walk and looked for some roughies up in the bush.
So, very cool.
So didn't get any, but you know what? Doesn't really matter.
No, I'm like that too. Take my gun for a walk a lot and stuff, but there's so much out there to take in and just enjoy life. So your hunting, I guess, career and your biology and scientific career were kind of like moving along together over the last four decades. So this is the real meat I want to get into here and understand you. How have you found being a hunter has helped you be a wildlife scientist? Or I guess the first part is, has it? Have you developed skills and senses and seeing things that make you a better scientist?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's aspects of hunting that are quite similar to what I do as a wildlife biologist. Because one of the things is, if you're going to be a wildlife biologist, you have to be able to find the species that you're studying. And so there's commonalities there with hunting, whether I'm doing it from a helicopter or if I'm doing it on foot. You have to understand things about habitat, animal behavior. And I think that the species that I hunt are very different than the species I actually study. You know, we don't hunt caribou down here, although I wish we could. We just, they're not allowed to anymore. There's not enough of them. And, but again, it comes down to that. There's some similarities in how you approach what you need to do. I mean, in terms of preparation, thinking about where you're going, how you're going to get there, what do you expect? And I mean, you sort of where they're different. I mean, when I'm out hunting, it's, I'm there to basically relax and enjoy an experience. If I'm out in a helicopter looking for polar bears, I'm working. It's incredibly interesting and I enjoy it immensely, but they're different mental processes that are going on. When I'm out hunting, I mean, we eat a lot of wild game in our house and always have. But I don't put any pressure on myself. I mean, there's enough meat in the freezer from last year that I'll get through no matter what. And I've got other things that we've harvested this year. So I'm not worried about it. And so there's very different mindsets, but I think there's some commonalities there. But one is really recreation and one is, it is a job and it's stressful. I mean, hunting isn't really expensive. Flying in helicopters is. So there's some different aspects that are going on there about, you know, you're flying in a helicopter, you want data. You know, for the price of being in the air, you need to get that. That's a deliverable. Out hunting, you just go for a nice day and it's great. You know, if you see something, it's even better. And if you get something, that might be an even bigger plus.
Well, that kind of makes you appreciate the hunters that are paying for a guided experience. So one, there's a pressure on the guide to deliver, and then you've paid X amount of dollars and you kind of want this experience and a take home, you know, at the end of it as well. And that's one of the reasons I never got into it is one, I didn't want to have to deal with those pressures of turning hunting into a job. But yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it as well.
Yeah. When the kids were smaller and our kids were at home, we ate a lot more meat. And so it was always kind of like, okay, yeah, if I'm going to be away for 10 days hunting, I should probably come home with the deer to just show that I was actually deer hunting and not just, you know, drinking beers with my friends in the bush. But now it's just something I look forward to every year, you know, and, I hunt for meat. I'm not like, yeah, if a big deer walks out with big antlers, I'm great for that. But, you know, it's when I'm hunting elk, I'm generally like, I don't think we could eat a bull elk. I don't know. I mean, and quite often, like for elk anyways, I usually hunt alone. So where I usually go hunting, I got to get it out of there on my own as well, unless I can convince somebody to come help me drag it out. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't hunt elk much this year. There was no snow on the ground and I got to bring an animal, you know, 5 kilometers back, and that area, you're not allowed motorized vehicles. So you got to do it on your back or on a toboggan, and toboggan over 5 kilometers of dirt and, you know, that wasn't sounding good.
No, that's for sure. I had to drag a deer this year, but not too far, maybe like 500 yards and no snow. When you have snow, it's just like they're like pulling a toboggan. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
When you hunt and you approach hunting, like it's a process as well. Like you said, there's some preparation. There's some, you know, where am I going to go? How am I going to approach the landscape, the species, timing, all this kind of stuff. Have you found that you approach that process of hunting in any way, shape, or form? Are you borrowing some of your scientific background, your approach to a problem, problem solving, the scientific method itself when you're hunting?
There's some similarities, because one of the things you have is a bit of a mental map. So when you think about where you're going hunting, there's certain things, you know, you can be looking, you know, at your app on your phone, if you've got a hunting app, you know, looking at topography or Google Maps and trying to look at terrain and where an animal might be from the perspective of, you know, going deer hunting. Where I deer hunt, I've been hunting in the area for, pretty much 40 years. So I know the landscape, I know the area. Now it changes with logging and access and things like that. And, but I kind of know the area already. That's a little bit different than when I go out onto the sea ice to look for polar bears. Although I know the areas usually, and so I have, again, a bit of a mental map of what areas are likely to be good based on the current conditions. It's a much more dynamic system than on land. I mean, although, you know, you go to a place where you saw a deer last year and there's nothing there. I mean, it does move around a lot. So you basically become quite adaptive in both systems, but there is some similarity. You try to sort of envision where you can go, how far you can get, where you're going to get back to at the end of the day. I mean, with a helicopter, we're on a big long tether called fuel. And if you run out of fuel, that's not a good thing. So you're always sort of looking at the time and getting back. And so there are some logistic components that are the same. You know, how far do I really want to haul that deer? How far do I really have with the helicopter to, you know, effectively work? You know, you fly out to the end of your fuel reserve or half of it. You can't do anything there if you find a bear because you got to get home to get more fuel. So there's some similarities. You're working with the ecology of the animal that you're trying to get. And that's the same whether we're out looking for grizzly bears to catch or polar bears. It's kind of the same thing. You're looking at habitat, where they're more likely to be. And there's some, you know, certain things that the animals are always looking for, and you want to be near what they're looking for. And that's usually, well, in the springtime when we're out on the sea ice, male polar bears are looking for females, and the females tend to be in certain types of sea ice types. And so we'll go there expecting to find females, but also knowing that some of the males will be in there. And that's the same thing, you know, during the rut when you're out hunting. You'd want to, you know, you're looking for sign to see that there's indications of, you know, breeding activity in the area, that there's scrapes or rubs going on. So there's some things that we're looking for. We're looking for those markers that tell us that there's activity here. And then you're always looking. It's just like when we're out hunting. My vast preference is to hunt when there's snow. Big game and snow to me is just, that's the magic time. And that's the same with polar bears, because the story's already written for you. And then it's up to you to sort of take those pieces and put them together. Okay, that was a big deer coming through. That scrape looks like it was cleaned up this morning. It's the same thing. We're going out on the sea ice. We see a seal kill that a polar bear has made. We stop. Okay, this is pretty old. Nobody's been here for quite a while. Or it's reasonably fresh. Yeah, let's see which is the freshest set of tracks leaving this area and get on that one, because somebody's come in, you know, in some hours ago, and then we can catch up to them pretty quick.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, that's that way you just described there kind of like mirrors a lot of how I approach it as well, like approach hunting, in that, you know, you're collecting data as a hunter, same as a scientist, right? Like you're seeing this, you're seeing that, you know, what does it mean? The track, it was here at a certain time, travel, what was he doing? And you've got this, I don't know, like a working hypothesis, I guess, when you're hunting, right? I think the deer is going to do this. I'm anticipating the buck to go there. And then you're taking all those little clues and seeing, does it fit the mental model, or do I got to go, okay, the data is telling me something different. I've got to adjust my hypothesis. And you're trying to bring the two together. And I always thought was kind of like applying the scientific method to hunting, other than, you know, you're sort of real time processing the data when you're hunting.
Yeah. You know, and I think what happens with time, once you become a more experienced hunter, there's also a lot of intuition going on. You sort of judge the situation that you're in. And I used to find it a lot more challenging when I was a younger hunter. I could go a lot further. I could cover a lot more territory, but that doesn't mean you see more game necessarily. And I think what happened for me is that over time, you start to become more intuitive about where you should be and when you should move and when you shouldn't move. Does this place look like a good place to set up for an hour or two to just sit and be quiet? Or is this a place where you could just cover ground and get somewhere better? And so I probably enjoy hunting a lot more in the last 10, 20 years than in the first 20 years, just because I find I don't have to think as much. I can more react to the environment. And I would say that that's the same thing with polar bears. I'm pretty confident if there's a bear around, I'll be able to find it by looking at the habitat, looking at where we are relative to other landscape features. Where's the best place to be at this time of year for a bear to be? So there's some similarities to it for sure.
Interesting. So would you go as far as saying like you develop a mental model like for hunting, you know, and understanding deer in the area that you hunt, and you've now reached a stage where you've been through the cycle of seeing what the deer do, being able to predict, connecting with the deer, filling your tag, and then you've reached the years where it's like my model, being my understanding of deer in this area, is pretty highly calibrated that I can say, oh, they're probably going to do this. Oh yeah, look, a buck went through here last night. And you're same as, you know, your science. You've reached a point with the understanding of polar bears where your models are calibrated quite well. Does that resonate with you? That sort of idea?
It does, you know, and I come back to it though, you know, with hunting and even finding bears, there's just an element of dumb luck. You know, you just happen to be in the right place at the right time. But doing the right thing does matter. And I mean, being in the right place at the right time can sort of be part of that learning process, I think. And I don't think I'm an excellent hunter, but I can fill my tags if I want to. It seems pretty reliably, you know, but I'm not overly selective. I'm not looking, you know, for some monster whitetail or mule deer when I'm out. I'm looking for something that would be good on the table for the most part. But, you know, I bump into a lot of deer. This year, I wasn't under any pressure. And I think I sent you a video that I took of, you know, a nice whitetail buck, and he's less than, you know, 10 meters away, less than that. And I'm just sitting there. I put the scope on him and I thought,
The fog was the steam was coming up off the deer and his breath. Oh, yeah. And yeah, it was gorgeous.
Yeah. I actually took more photos of deer this year than I ever have done, but it was just, again, it was no pressure because I do have meat in the freezer, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll take something. And then it just didn't work out. And I didn't have a lot of time this year. I had other obligations, so I didn't get out quite as long. And so I just put it aside and I thought, oh, well, we'll clean out the freezer and I'll be much keener next fall.
Cool. When you look around at, you know, your students, your colleagues, you know, worldwide, do you think in the generations now or your colleagues or students that aren't hunters, but they're, you know, following in your footpaths or you're helping them become wildlife scientists and stuff, do you see that, you know, I'll make an assumption that probably the majority are not hunters, you know, like yourself. Are you seeing anything where you're kind of going, you know, if you learned to hunt and you were also wanted to do this as a career, you'd probably like be a little bit better at it, or you'd learn a little bit more? Like, I guess what I'm getting at is do you see something that maybe is missing in wildlife science today because fewer people in these fields are hunters? Not that they're going about, oh, this is why we have to keep the deer season, you know, that type of thing, but just in this whole way of seeing animals, seeing the world, understanding those connections as a hunter, and then being a little bit better wildlife scientist because of that?
Oh, definitely. Really? You know, when I started out in this business, you know, I was at UBC in Vancouver, and back then, I mean, the people interested in wildlife, that was the hook and bullet club, right? That was people that wanted to hunt and fish. That's who went into wildlife research. That was us. And it was predominantly male. That was sort of the development. Now, wildlife ecology as a profession or wildlife management has really diversified greatly in lots of ways. And of course, there's a lot more females in the profession now. But one of the things, and I do, like when I started my first lecture this week in my biology of mammals, I tell my students I hunt. I make it clear that that's part of what I do. And I explain a little bit about why. I don't try to, you know, turn people into hunters, but if they express an interest, I tell them what they can do. And for like my graduate students that are doing masters or doctorates with me, I encourage them to take the hunter education course. And I've had even vegans do this, you know, not because necessarily that I think that they want to go eat meat or go hunting, but if you're going to work in this profession, at least having some fundamental understanding of the type of training, the baseline training that people are getting is really important. And then the other thing is that I have mentored some students that have been really interested in hunting, taking them out. I don't do it a lot, mainly because then it becomes sort of like my recreation becomes almost like my work as well when I'm, you know, so there's a work-life balance thing going on. But one of the interesting things is one of my students at University of Alberta here has started a more formalized hunter mentorship program. And so it's done for students at the university. And this last year, the student, Remington Bratcher, set up a whole bunch of mentored hunting days, took people out waterfowl hunting, and basically sets it up with some people to go out, I think they were mainly doing field hunts, which works really well for a group. But he also took some people out onto his own private property and they harvested a few white-tailed deer down that way. So again, there's an interest there. And I think it's actually the next generation is really interested in organic free-range meat, which is what, of course, you're getting when you're out harvesting your own animals. And so there is an interest there. And so when students express that, I encourage it. But I also encourage them for professional development to take, you know, your hunting license, but also to get, you know, a possession and acquisition license for firearms. Not again because you want to hunt, but it's again understanding sort of what's going on in terms of the training that people have. So if you're going to work with hunters as a professional, you should at least have some experience there, understanding what it's about. So people come into this field for all sorts of different reasons. The hunting and fishing crowd is still there, but not in the majority that it used to be. Now we get a lot of birders and people just interested in you know, the effects of humans on the natural world.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And which is fair. I mean, there's way more wildlife species that, you know, are not huntable game species than there are. So there's definitely like a place for everybody, but yeah, I think, you know, I really like what you're saying, you know, especially if you're going into the field where you're some way, shape or form, or maybe your research or your direct work is going to overlap, even if it's to inform decisions about hunting, understanding that is, you know, doesn't mean you have to do it, but understanding it or having gone through it, I would just assume is going to make you a better wildlife scientist down the road, whether it's advising on policy or sustainable management or whatever.
I think that's true. And, you know, there's not always the best relationship between wildlife biologists and the hunting public. You know, you only have to go on enough of the outdoor forums to read that not everybody agrees with what the biologist says is going on in terms of, you know, should we be hunting this animal here or there, or what should the quota be or not, you know. And I think a lot of that comes down to sort of a different way of looking at wildlife. One is sort of from a management perspective and one is as a user. And sometimes I don't think those are always compatible. And there's always sort of a sense that one group wants to take more than is allowed or more than is possible would be a better way to put it. Whereas the biologists are quite often trying to put a cap on how many are taken, but it depends on the objectives. You know, with chronic wasting, a lot of the hunting seasons in Alberta have been liberalized to try to keep the deer population down. So it depends, but it a good biologist has a good rapport with the hunters in their area, and that really is an important component of sort of bridging that gap. And it's a challenging field because, you know, as they say in wildlife management, you know, 90% of wildlife management is human management.
Yeah, understanding humans.
One thing we can, you know, that's the one thing we can influence, you know, with openings and closings for seasons, for example.
Yeah. No, that's true. I just wish we spent as much investing in researching the human animal and its relationship to the species and hunters as we do in the actual wild animal itself, going, why did they move there? Why are they aggregating over here? What do they like to eat? What time of the year are they going to show up here? You know, I mean, not that we're understanding that about humans, but it's like, what are the beliefs? What are the values? What's important? What outcomes do people want? And because that's essentially half the decision-making, as you know, in wildlife management is, well, what do people want out of this deal? And what can nature sustainably, there we go. I slipped up on that word, provide, you know, to meet those goals. So yeah. Not a lot of social science.
No. Yeah, it's there's a lot of social science involved in this, and you know what makes a day a successful hunt for anybody as well. You know, and for me personally, I don't want to see a lot of other hunters. You know, that's one of the things I want to get into an area where I think that I'm not going to see other people. I'd rather not bump into other hunters. I hunt on foot. I don't have an ATV. So I'm going to go into this area and I go into places where I'm pretty darn sure that there's not going to be ATVs because there's no established trails or any trail I'm on hasn't been cleared for so long that nobody's going to do it. You know, I don't want to get into those areas and then find, you know, people quadding around. It changes your day. And so I'm lucky enough. I know the areas I hunt well enough that there's some low likelihood of meeting somebody out there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm the same way. I'd rather spend a day and not see a person and not see any game animals than to see a lot of both.
Yeah. I'm with you on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's why you're out there, I think. And that's the motivation. So that makes a good day for me. I mean, having a chance at an animal, that's always fun. Getting something that can be really rewarding. You know, but again, it depends on what your metrics are. For me, I just, you know, I was out elk hunting this year and it was opening morning. I got to an area where I've shot cow elk before. And I was sitting there in my spot waiting, sun's up. All of a sudden, three nice bulls come over the horizon. I'm thinking, I should have applied for a bull tag because they were definitely within range. And then I had to sort of give my head a shake and I'm thinking, no, I don't want to drag a bull out of this area. It's way too far in. Well, I did see a couple of cows, but I just didn't get a chance. But it was the lack of snow just kind of put me off this year. I'd rather be in there where I have some, you know, for me, hunting is a bit of a problem solving event as well. Like we were talking about, it's what's been through here. When have they been through here? And that gets a lot harder when you're just looking at, you know, dirt and dry leaves on the ground, trying to figure out, you know, how, you know, you can look at scat and see how fresh it is, but it's not the same, you know, sort of getting that sort of interactive sort of excitement that something's just been through here. You know, it snowed last night and you know that they're here, or the frost in the tracks says that these are really fresh. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, snow makes reading that book a lot easier. That's for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I must be a slow reader, I guess, is maybe what it is when it comes to that stuff. Like I love that. That for me, the tracks tell the story, and that's, you know, it's not just also the animals that you're hunting, but it's what else is out there. You know, I was out whitetail hunting a number of years back, and we're not too far from one of the places where grizzly bears come out of sort of the foothills in Alberta. And I've been hunting there for 40 years and I'm walking along and there's a perfectly fresh set of grizzly bear tracks in the snow. And I'm kind of going, okay, I didn't know there were grizzlies in this area now. But of course, they've been slowly expanding when they shut down the harvest in Alberta. You know, it's almost a couple of decades ago now. And so they shut that down and the bears have slowly been creeping out into areas. But, you know, knowing you're hunting in an area with grizzlies is a bit different. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah.
Seeing the fact that there's
I got to worry about them when I'm turkey hunting.
Yeah. Different time of year. But I was surprised because it was pretty cold, but the bear was still out moving about. You know, where I hunt, there's a lot of wolves and, you know, seeing wolf tracks. Maybe I don't want to be hanging around here if the wolves have really been pounding this area for the last, you know, little while. So you move to someplace else where there's a little bit less activity. So, you know, it's there's a story there that you're reading when you're out.
No, absolutely. And it's a great story. How many more decades of polar bear research are you planning?
Oh, I don't have decades left in me. I've been doing this for 40 years now. And so I got some years left. I think, you know, there's a next generation. And at some point, the old guard does have to stand aside and make space for the next generation to come through. And, you know, I've got a couple of my students that I've trained up that can easily take over. Some of them are already working on polar bears for different government agencies. And they can certainly take over and keep moving the science forward. And, you know, it's I think there's still some years left in the old dog.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I imagine it'll be one of those things where you're going to go, well, I think I'm good. I'm going to call it a career. And then you'll be sitting there missing the Arctic, the sea ice, and the sight of a big lone animal strolling across there. Like, then you're going to be like, oh, did I make the right decision?
I think there's a good likelihood of that, you know, but I think that I'll spend more time fishing. I'll spend more time
the next chapter.
I've got really high priority on a pronghorn that I've never had the chance to go follow up down in southern Alberta here. So that's on my list. That might be the only animal, if I could find a nice one, that I might put on a wall.
Cool.
My wife doesn't want a lot of deadheads in the house, but that might be one that I would actually put as
they're so pretty. I think it would be a shame not to. They're so pretty and so unique in North America. Wow, this has been such a great conversation. I love understanding scientists that are hunters and, you know, how these two worlds like meld together. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing your personal, like you got your hunter hat on when we met quite a few years ago, you had your work hat on. So this has been really fun to kind of catch up with you and wear your hunter's hat mostly in this conversation. So I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a fun chat, you know, talking hunting, fishing, that sort of stuff. That's just always good fun. Polar bears are fun too, but that does feel like work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. There's no pressure when we're talking hunting and hunting stories and experiences. So, cause it's not work.
You betcha. Yeah. Good chat.
Yeah. Thank you, Andy.